Malcolm Dixon is my latest nostalgia interview guest. Malcolm is the head of quality assurance at the University of Kent, and he's just published his first novel, The Little House on Everywhere Street. And we learn from Malcolm that writing fiction is more indicative of who he is than his day job. And he tells me why good writing is an exercise in misdirection. Now, Malcolm has written short stories in the past. His novel is about a house with doors that lead on to different cities. It's What Makes a Family Happy, in which the family members have misadventures and go missing in time. Now, Malcolm talks about growing up in Liverpool in a different time when it was a deprived city. He reveals that he has a prodigious memory and can remember the great winter of 1963. Also, he remembers going to see the Beatles in 1965. He can even remember learning to walk. We talk about listening to the charts on a Tuesday lunchtime and to football matches on the radio. Malcolm did his first degree in Sunderland. He went to graduate school at the University of Minnesota on a sports scholarship. We learn about his love of football, and he tells me about the time he met Ed Stewart, my own radio hero. Stewpot was a genuine football and Everton fan, and even corrected Malcolm on a football fact. Malcolm's parents were born in the early 1920s. He talks about his father's seaman's log. We learn about how Malcolm ended up doing his present role and how it isn't who he is. And we learn what his wife thinks his superpower is. With his new book, he knew this was it. He talks about how people believed in the project, and he has other books, including a trilogy, in the pipeline. And at the end of the interview, we find out that Malcolm's memories are mainly positive and that there isn't much that he is nostalgic about other than his children's childhood. It was fantastic to catch up, and very timely as well, because The Little House on Everywhere Street is out at the beginning of February 2022. Wonderful to catch up with Malcolm Dixon for the latest in my series of nostalgia interviews. My name is Chris Deasy. Well, it is a great pleasure this week to meet Malcolm Dixon. And Malcolm, we were just saying before we started that we've both been at the University of Kent for a very long time, but you beat me by 3 years.
Yeah, I came 1st September 2001, yeah. So over 20 years ago. I started the same day as Sir David Melville.
Oh.
But I've lasted longer, Sir David, so...
You know. Yeah. So did you have a bet at the time? Like, who's going to still be here in 20 years?
It was probably always odds on going to be me, but yeah, it's me.
And I always see you as obviously our QA Uber person, you know, the person who knows everything about university exam boards and procedures. But that's not the reason, of course, that we're here to talk, because I was absolutely thrilled when I saw your book advertised a week or so ago, which has just been published and won lots of awards, as I understand it.
Well,
by the time this interview goes out, you know, the Nobel Prize for Literature.
You never know. It's been here before.
Yeah. And so, do you want to say a little bit about what you've just published?
It isn't out yet. It's out 2nd of Feb next year, so not too far now. But it is a young adult novel, which I wrote in 2017. And it's taken a while for it to filter through and to get some attention. I mean, it's a very long process. And finally, I mean, I heard about the prize a long time ago, but it's finally coming out. It's taken a long time at this point.
Is there something about, I always think of the word counterpoint, that we all have, you know, there's the day job, when you do things in a certain way and look at a certain set of data or text, that is a different sort, very sort of different literature to what you do with your young adult novel. But then you wrote this novel, and as I understand it from the press release, you wrote it on campus in the library at lunchtime.
Well, I wrote it everywhere. I mean, I did write it, a lot of it on my phone. I'd say mostly at weekends, but then if I was riding a train or going to a cafe or going to the library at lunchtime, then I would edit what I'd done and add to it throughout the week. Yeah. And I've been doing that for a long time. So,
and was this always an ambition to do this?
Always an ambition, yeah. I mean, all my studies when I did go to university, both here and in the States, it's always been geared towards producing some form of writing that I was pleased with.
Yeah. 'Cause I've always found, as somebody who keeps a diary, and anybody who listens to the podcast, although yeah, he's mentioned the diary again. Yeah. But the funny thing is, it's almost like when you're younger, you almost want to say, you know, take me seriously. I'm going to write all these, in my case, you know, write these academic books. But you also think that that's only a part of who you are. And I think, having once been the director, as in those days, director of learning and teaching, I just felt that almost every day I was just reading module specs, to the point that almost like, I can't see the wood for the trees, I can't see the learning outcomes for the program outcomes, and so on. But when I do the diary, people say, but, you know, you spend all this time of an evening doing it, or, you know, if I see a film, I'll do a review and so on. And it's a labour of love. But if I'm not doing those things, even though they take up a lot of time, something feels missing. The same with the podcast, I suppose. But it sounds like it's the same with you and the novel that you've just published.
Yeah, I mean, that's always been the main activity. Yeah. And the other stuff I do is really just to, it's just to buy me time to concentrate on doing the main activity, which has been writing fiction for a long time.
So that's interesting. So in terms of, you know, that sort of question of how do you define yourself, or so it sounds like the fiction perhaps is more indicative of who you are.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah. I mean there are things that are similar, and I've said on different occasions, different audience, that I think there is overlap between the two, what I do. And I have this theory that good writing is an exercise in misdirection, that it is maintaining credibility. And the work that I do at Kent in terms of convincing external people that we are completely sound is an exercise in not telling the truth, but saying, read this. This makes perfect sense. This is plausible. Yeah. You believe in this. You don't even want to look somewhere else, because this is all perfectly right. Yeah. And I think it's the same with fiction, that you grab the reader from the first sentence and keep their attention.
Yeah. I always think that there's always this, I mean, everyone has a hinterland, I suppose, but, and some people obviously are happy to promote that and show it off and indeed have it published, but has it changed people's perceptions of you? I mean, I suppose in my case, obviously, we're chatting about this now, even though I've known you for years, but not known you very well, but were people surprised? Maybe some people knew that you were doing this. Or did they think, Malcolm, I just, you know, had no idea that this is what you did?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, there have always been people at Kent who have known. Yeah. I haven't gone about saying, I'm a writer. But I have people interested in that, or they do something similar and we have a conversation. I mean, I've had some good supporters here at Kent. The late Dave Reason was a big supporter. And I was very grateful to Dave. We worked together quite a long time ago, Dave and I. And we just got talking, and I was telling him about things I'd written. He read something, and he was very complimentary. And it was a big support. I met Dave on the street with his wife one day 6 years ago. And he introduced me to his wife, saying, this is Malcolm. He's a very gifted writer. So that was, you know, very kind of him to... Yeah. But it was nice of him to see me in that way.
Yeah.
So people, I don't hide it, but I haven't been around shouting about it.
Yeah. But you have every reason to do it now. I'd love to know a bit about what the book is about, because I read the blurb, and actually it's probably better that you say it than I do. But the bit that sticks in my mind is the idea of, is it like a house with lots of doors, and each door leads somewhere to a different part of someone's life.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah. I mean, I did for a long time write very serious short stories. And some of them would come out in, like, the London magazine, which is the UK's oldest lit journal, from 1735. It's published Keats and Wordsworth and all the greats and me. But I found that wasn't really opening the doors that I would have liked it to. And we were fortunate in my family. I have a wife and two daughters. And we're fortunate that we've got to take some nice holidays. And we had some friends who live in New York. And Paris is quite easy to get to from Kent. And so we had a series of holidays in Brooklyn and a series of holidays in Paris. Very nice. The travelling, of course. And so we used to have this story where we said, wouldn't it be great that if we lived in a house where you opened the front door and you're in London? Yeah. and the side door you were in Paris, then the back door you were in a New York City. And so I began to think of what that house would be like, what sort of family would live in their house, and how would living there affect them. And so that was the premise. It came out of a kind of a family discussion, really.
And they're always the best things. That it's, there's something very real and grounded, and often, especially when children are involved, uh-huh. sometimes it's sort of, you know, that you know what resonates. Uh-huh. But I can absolutely see the appeal of that, and I think it's interesting that now that we've been used to lockdown for so long, that of course, as I found with the interviews as well, whereas once I used to travel, or somebody would have to travel to me to do the interview, now it's a case of going into Teams or to Zoom, yeah. press a few buttons, and then you're in New York, or you're uh-huh. in New Zealand, uh-huh. or you're talking to somebody the other side of the world, and apart from the time difference, yeah. it's a very, very straightforward business. But that notion... it sounds like something like Twilight Zone-ish as well, uh-huh. Back to the Future. But that is something that I'm guessing really resonated with your family. But without giving too much away, what was there a sense that these different doors opened up onto sort of different parts of one's psyche or somebody's past? I mean, I'm guessing there's a nostalgia element to some of this.
Not so much about psyche, I would say. I mean, it splits the way the family live. And I suppose ultimately the novel is about what makes for a happy family. There's some misadventure because the house, you've already mentioned about time zones. And at some point the children become aware that they each go to school in a different city in a different country, but all at the same time. Yeah. So they realise that there's a time control. Mm. And they find out more about that. Then there's a misadventure, and the youngest of the three children goes missing in time, and it becomes an adventure to try and find them. But there are some other factors behind the scenes that are happening too.
Yeah. Well, I'm definitely going to buy it. I was going to say for my children to read, but no, I'm going to read it. Yeah. I don't care what the children want to read.
Yeah, I mean, it isn't written for children per se. I mean, I think any reader who's interested in reading from age 12 and up to 112... Yeah. would find it an interesting read, he said, as the author.
Well, no, and you're yeah. entitled to do that, yeah. and that helps me. Well, my eldest is 9, so that's fine. I've got a few years to uh-huh. to savour it, and then
my eldest daughter worked for a year between courses in a local school in Margate, and she felt it would be she was teaching kids aged 8 and 9. She felt it'd be good for them too, so there are other views, but I haven't written it down at all for children. It's written, there are no concessions made. It's written to be well written, but also to be very enjoyable.
Yeah. And I'm so excited because it sounds like the sort of, because I go to the cinema a lot, but if I saw a film with that premise, uh-huh. that would just be like, you know, that why hasn't somebody thought of it before? Uh-huh. And I'm talking to the person who's written that. You know, who knows? Yeah. Maybe.
I have mentally cached the film, but yeah.
I like that, mentally cached the film. Well, yeah. you know, maybe you'll be able to cash it in real currency uh-huh. in due course. But do you want to say a little bit about your background as well in terms of because although I don't know, I'm guessing that there's a Merseyside element.
That's right. Yeah, yeah. I did grow up in. Liverpool, lived there until, it was always home, but I'd lived there until I was 21 or so. And I still went back for quite some time, but then I lived there for a year in 1990, since then, when I was about 30, but apart from that, I haven't. Yeah.
And you're all the way here, over here in Kent, and does that feel like, because I'm from Cardiff originally, although... People say, but you don't sound it, but that's, I'm sure there's another story there. But you've been here a long time, and we have plenty of students from that side of the world as well. But you've been here for a very long time in Kent. Does it feel very different to growing up in Liverpool?
Yeah, it was Liverpool in a different time as well. I mean, I'm 62. I was born in the 50s. And so I grew up in Liverpool in the 60s, 70s, early 80s. And it was a very deprived city then, at that time. It was a different experience to the experience here. So even though parts of Kent are very deprived, etc., I can. It doesn't seem quite the same extremes as it felt then. But Liverpool in the mid 80s, the city centre had whole rows of shops all boarded up. So it was a very harsh time.
Yeah, and also I'm guessing in that sense, in terms of the 60s, I'm not sure how much. Well, I'm just in terms of trying to work out when you were born. But I mean, the 60s and Liverpool. I mean, I saw a film called Last Night in Soho the other week, which although Soho, London, but you know, Cilla Black plays a big role in that film. And I'm just thinking that, you know, and that film Yesterday, based on sort of what if the Beatles didn't exist. Yeah. But I mean, Liverpool, I have been to Liverpool, never been to the city centre, I've been to Liverpool Hope a couple of times over the years. But that just feels like the place that anybody and everybody would want to grow up in.
Yeah, I mean, it was great. I've come from a large family, just myself and my sister, but it's very extended in terms of aunties and uncles and cousins. So that side of things isn't quite the same now. I don't think my children know one of their grandmothers, but the rest of it is a bit far away. Yeah. I do have a kind of a prodigious memory. I was born in 59, but I remember things from the 60s. I can remember the great winter of 63, believe it or not. I can remember going in 65 to be outside the Odeon when the Beatles came to the... I can remember Everton winning the FA Cup in 66. I was only seven or so. I can remember all that stuff.
Yeah. Have you ever kept a diary?
No, not really.
So this is all memory. So you I mean, I suppose it's unlikely that a four-year-old would keep a diary. But I think you mentioned the 63. I remember my dad, I mean, growing up in Cardiff, he passed his driving test, and I think he said it was something like the last day before you had like the 6 month snow, you know, whatever it was. So like it was snowing in April, but so 63, not the winter of discontent, but the winter of winter.
I can remember that. I remember things from my very young childhood, which people would probably believe that I'm inventing, but I can remember learning to walk, which is extraordinary. I can remember how I felt about it. I remember. The challenge of moving from a chair to a couch, I could rest on the couch, and then going back again. And my mum tells me that I walked quite young, so that's strange.
Have you always had those memories, or have they sort of surfaced more, particularly as a writer as well, where you're harnessing them?
No, I've always had them. They've always been there. Yeah. I can remember learning colours. I could only learn brown, because I learned green at the same time, and I could distinguish the two things. Yeah.
I mean, that's formidable, because do you find that you are able to recall more recent things in the same sort of way, or is it more the childhood, the growing up things that stand out?
The important things I can. I mean, there's a lot of stuff I just wipe straight with, stuff to do with work, so much paperwork. I concentrate on it at the time, but afterwards it's gone.
I find that I've got this memory that can be very... kind of selective. So if I'm in conversations and sometimes somebody might be talking about some, you know, particular like detail of, I don't know, fiscal policy or something, I've got nothing to contribute, but I might have some recollection of a, because I watched it at the time, like the leadership contest or something, you know, involving various politicians from the 90s, whether it's Heseltine or Clark or, you know, and Tony Blair and all that, and remembering who was, it's a bit like football in that way, of who comes first, who comes second, who's the runner-up and who has to be eliminated.
Yeah.
And those sort of things I can engage with, but it's a little bit niche. But if I'm having a conversation with somebody and I feel a little bit sort of out of kilter, I've got nothing to contribute, then I kind of bring that from somewhere, and often it stops the conversation, but it makes me feel at least better. That rather than saying nothing at all, I kind of feel I've contributed in my own terms.
I did know which football team won which trophy in which season. There was a time when I was hitchhiking between Newcastle and Liverpool quite often, and I was picked up by a high powered hairdresser who was listening to a then current radio show, which was Guess the Year, and the second the DJ mentioned this football team won this trophy, I knew straight away which year it was, which made me very unpopular with the guy who was giving me the lift, because I was spoiling it for him.
Yeah,
so that's definitely 1971.
And it sounds like that famous Whatever Happened to the Lightly Lads episode when they're doing everything they can to avoid seeing the result of the football, yeah. but then they overhear it, I think, or they That's see it on the billboard.
Yeah. I went to graduate school at the University of Minnesota, and it was a time when Everton played Liverpool in the first Mersey Cup final, and I avoided the score. I tried to avoid it because it was a time lag, but it got spoiled. Yeah. So, you know.
Yeah. Well, but these days it would be next to impossible, wouldn't it?
It would.
In a world of social media.
Yeah, it would be. Yeah. Yeah. Then I was mostly dependent on... I was in the School of English, but across the street was the School of Journalism. I used to go across there most days to check out the Times. You know, the Times would come in like 4 days later. So I'd check on the football scores. Mm. But my colleagues thought I was very interested in world news. I was going over there to read all these papers. Now I just wanted to know how Everton had gotten on at the most recent game.
Yeah. Now, you just reminded me that it was in 2000 I went... One of my first trips abroad, I was like 27 when I went overseas. And I went to Switzerland to a film festival. And the newspapers there were... It was the previous days, you know, so it was a whole day. So Friday we got Thursday's paper, that sort of thing. And I was going in, I was looking at all like the radio schedules, all that sort of stuff. And it was like, here I am in this wonderful, it was in Locarno, and a sort of this mega, you know, beautiful place, like second only to Cannes in terms of, you know, scenery. And there's me looking at like to see the Radio 2 listings. But that was what I did. You know, I suppose these days it's like listening to stuff on the radio now, and you'll have contestants on quizzes, and it's like, where are you from? And you normally expect like Romsford or Birmingham or whatever, and they say, you know, like Minnesota, you know, you have on Radio 2, you'll have people from, you know, saying we listen every week without fail. Of course, instead of the breakfast show, might be like, you know, the drive time show. did radio play a big role when you were growing up?
Mostly, really, I would say, well, yeah, I mean, we used to listen to the charts, we used to try and get home at Tuesday lunchtime because they'd be announced at a certain time. And of course, on the Sunday, they would have your little tape machine ready to play the ones you wanted to keep. So there was that side of things. Probably listened to a lot of football games on radio, on Radio City, Liverpool, or Radio Merseyside. In that sense.
And it's pretty obvious that the football interests go back to a very, very young age. Uh-huh. Were you playing? Did you ever play football?
Play football. That's the easy answer. We all played in teams. It's, you know, we played in school and in teams, etc. I did start a co-ed football team at the University of Minnesota. I had a job as a soccer referee. I was for the co-ed league, etc. And I met three guys from Cork who were playing for a frat team. Three engineers. And I joined their team, and then the following year in the School of English, I did encourage my colleagues to participate in this foreign import sport. We had played softball together as a group, but then we also played soccer. So that was good.
So you're responsible for bringing soccer to the United States.
It was there. I had a fully scholarship that I could. I had free tuition, but also meant I could take any sports course that I wanted to. And I did 3 mornings a week, used to get up and play football, play soccer.
Was that an undergraduate?
Postgrad.
Where did you do your first degree?
I did a first degree at Sunderland Poly. And given how, I mean, I left school and got a job, but I worked in local education department for 4 years, and I did A levels at night school, including English, which was my preferred choice. And compared to how the forensic way my wife and I and my daughters picked out the right course and the right institution for them over many open days and much analysis, I remember one work time I just went down to the local library, went upstairs to the shelves with all the institutional prospectuses, picked the first one off the top shelf that had a first division football team and a degree in English, and applied there. Yeah. And from Sunderland, I was encouraged to apply. There was an exchange of professors at that time, and the professor from the States encouraged me to apply to his institution. So I applied there, and I was lucky to get a scholarship. I did a master's degree. I did technically switch into the PhD course, but really it was a ruse to get 6 months more funding to finish off the master's degree.
Oh,
I've never confessed that before, sorry.
Oh, no, well, it's just between you and us and however many millions happen to be listening. I was thinking, Minnesota, that's where Fargo is set, isn't it? The Coen Brothers film, is that right?
Fargo is in Dakota, which is just next state over.
Oh, it's the next one over. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
But it is very, you know, it's very cold state in winter, very hot state in the summer. Yeah. They call it the nation's icebox and the nation's oven.
Yeah, because of the times of year. Yeah.
Because, it's extreme.
Yeah. And just sticking, you were mentioning 1959, because I always ask the question, do you know what was in, you know, the charts when you were born? But I have a feeling in your case, although I'm guessing that you wouldn't remember that. Your memory may not go back to the day you were born. But do you have any idea what was in the chart, you know, what was number one maybe when you were born?
No, I haven't done that. I can tell you that FA Cup was won by Luton.
Yeah.
But I can't remember.
Can you remember the football, the FA Cup every year? It sounds like you can.
For a long time I could. It's become a bit blurred now. Yeah. I mean, now it's mostly either Chelsea or Manchester United. But then there was a lot of... Previous, it was a real... I suppose it has been won by Leicester recently. But it was a real competition where you had hope.
Because in the days before social media, growing up, in the playground at school, it was the days of the football albums and the stickers.
Uh-huh.
And even to this day, I remember Emlyn Hughes, because in later years he did a question of sport, but I've got that image and everybody, you know, the cachet, which players were more valuable than others and all that. And although I was never into football, I played along and everyone else did.
Uh-huh.
But there was a nice sense of community. I mean, it was competitive, because if you had the card that a real football player wanted and I had it and he didn't, you know, then there would be a rivalry for sure.
Yeah. I mean, it is... the lingua franca of my family. I mean, we're all scattered all over the place. I've still got a couple of cousins and a sister who live still on Merseyside, but the rest of us are scattered all over the place. Not that recently, but a couple of years ago, 11 or 12 of us got tickets for a Fulham versus Everton game, and it was my godfather, who's 10 years my senior, his sons, who are, they all live in Vancouver now. My cousin Liverpool and one of their daughters said, so there's about 11 or 12 of us all got together. And I know some of them better than others, but it was just very easy. It was just straight in, no awkwardness, and there's a feeling from being amongst family that you don't get from being with other groups. And I don't get that very often. I mean, I have my own family, which is great. But being in that bigger group as well brought something that I don't experience generally. I mean, I live in Cairns. My wife's from the south. Her family are great to me as well. But that sense of that community that I had as a child was just different feeling.
And also because sometimes, you know, I mean, I find it, if it hadn't been for the Second World War, my grandparents would have stayed in their villages. You know, they would never have moved, and then, well, I wouldn't be here. But it sounds as though maybe, I'm guessing your family's from Liverpool, you know, going way back. But then your generation started to scatter, which is, you know, a very, especially now when, I mean, my sister and I were the first generation in our family to go to university, but, you know, we no longer live in Cardiff. And then our parents, and it's only after we left Wales, actually around the time I came here 17 years ago, that they thought, well, there's kind of nothing to keep us, you know, here anymore. So, but if we'd stayed in Wales, they no doubt would still be there. But it's like suddenly one person, it's the domino effect, one person goes and then others follow. And it sounds like in your family, when you mentioned Vancouver as well, it sounds like a real...
Yeah.
Diaspora, almost.
Yeah, people have moved all over the place. And not just with family, but with friends, too. I mean, I was... there was a group of us from school who... once I decided to do A-levels at night school, we left school and we got jobs. And I decided to do that. I didn't tell them. It was an odd thing that I just said one day. I was fed up and I needed to do something a bit different. But they both copied me the following year. And they both did it as well. And then they both went. So they, that impacted on them. And they did the same thing. So they went to universities in like Reading and elsewhere.
Yeah. So you mentioned Everton as well. And just before we started recording, I was actually thrilled. I thought, how do you know who my radio hero is? But you were telling me about another football fan. So I've got my connection is radio rather than through Everton, but Ed Stewart.
Yeah, I was fortunate enough. My brother-in-law had worked at Spurs for a long time, 15 years or so. And he ran the corporate lounges there, and he got me a ticket for Spurs Everton. And there's a sort of place where you come in, and it's the executive lounge. There's a group of people to be entertained, usually from companies, etc. The ex-Spurs greats there, and I was on the table with Ed Stewart. That was nice. He was very much a genuine football fan. We had a conversation with some ex-footballers, Alan Mullery, Martin Chivers, Pat Jennings. But Spurs is the site of Everton's record league defeat. We were beaten there 10-4 in 1958. And it's memorable because there was an Everton player scored a hat-trick, but still got hammered. And there were two players in the team called Harris. And I picked the wrong one. And Ed corrected me. And I wasn't sure, but he was right.
Yeah.
Afterwards, I checked it. So he's a real fan.
Yeah. But I suppose in that sort of situation, you're probably thinking, well, you know, if I'm going to be wrong to anybody, you don't mind then, because actually, do you really want to know more about Everton than somebody who like has this very public profile? And you get on the right side of them.
I could give Ed that one.
Yeah. I mean, did you also grow up in a whole world of Cracker Jack or Junior Choice?
Yeah, I remember watching Cracker Jack. We moved house in '66, so. We used to watch it before then, so I remember watching it as early as 65.
Yeah. And I was just thinking as well, because the role, we mentioned social media a moment ago, but the role of media or TV, radio, and on the charts. I mean, I'm obviously a very, well, literally a different generation to my children, but the things that they grow up with, where it's social media first and foremost, or YouTube, you know, if they want to watch something, they watch something that they want to watch, and they may watch the same thing over and over. Whereas, I say, when we were growing up, it was always the case that you'd look at BBC One or BBC Two, ITV, etc. And there's always that very set, you know, sense of what's available, what, and everyone. But there was that virtual community of everybody watching, in many cases, the same thing. So there was enough because the choice wasn't there. And I just kind of feel now that I have this disconnect from my own children, because that their go-to is something that is not even remotely on my radar. Mm-hmm. And I actually think, and it's not even in a bad way, I suppose, but the fact I'm doing all this work on nostalgia is interesting, because it just makes me think that this doesn't bear any relationship to when I grew up. But perhaps my experience of growing up was a lot closer to my own parents, who were born in the 1940s, than my own children. So somewhere along the way, there's been some, you know, seismic changes in the way that we use data. My children sometimes can use my phone better than I can, and they're only in, the twins are six, so you know everything seems to be sort of out of kilter. And I think particularly with you and the prodigious memory that you have, is there a sense in which you're always sort of thinking of those displacements and the sort of, that was what it was like, this is how it is now? You know, I find on a day-to-day basis, I'm always very aware of the things that maybe we take for granted now, but we had to really struggle, you know, because you can't miss what you don't know, that, you know, what you haven't got. But at the same time, if you wanted to make a phone call, you had to queue up outside, when I was at university, for 6 o'clock, when it was cheaper. Everyone was queuing up to use the phone.
Yeah, I mean, I do tell my kids, my daughters are, one's about to say 23 and one's 19. And so they're perhaps on the cusp of where your kids are. I mean, they do watch things on YouTube, etc. But we did share watching shows together. I mean, I did influence them. We all watched Buffy the Vampire Slayer together long after it was first on. And since they've been away to uni, they're the only people who have seen it. And they introduce it to their friends. So it seems, from my experience, a little bit of a blend of shared things and things that are just for them. So their experience doesn't seem too different to mine, yeah. From my perspective.
Yeah, and I think in my case, it may well be that I'm older now, certainly than my mother was when I went to university. So I realised that generationally, I'm literally, you know, my parents' generation when I was the age that my students who I uh-huh. teach were. And what that does to your sense of self as well.
Yeah. My parents had a very different experience. They're both born 1920, 21, so quite a long time ago. They lived through the war. They, you know, they had active roles. My mother was in the Wrens. My father was in the Merchant Navy, but was torpedoed. Spent time at sea in an open boat, etc. So, and Liverpool, of course, suffered greatly in the war. You see photographs of the entire town centre just flattened. And there was I did do a little bit of writing which has never seen the light of day about that period in that city. Mostly because it was their experience. I wanted to try and understand some element of that. I remember going to the National Newspaper Library in Colindale, as was. Didn't live too far from there at one point. And researching all the Liverpool papers from that time and making notes, etc. So I could have this... I wanted to really understand their experience that they went through during the war, etc. But you know, they were very much people of their time. Of their experiences.
Yeah. It was my grandfather in his later years, in his 80s and 90s, started the process of writing up the events from the day he met his wife of 62 years, our grandmother, in 1941.
Yeah.
And so he was in his... it was after she died. So from 85, when he died, he was 95, maybe not for the last couple of years, but certainly well into his 90s. He was remembering, and he... he was quite gifted, really, because he remembered things very conversationally. Mm. And I thought, there's no way he can actually remember every single conversation. Mm. But he wrote it in that sort of, in a very sort of colloquial way, of very conversationally. And it really brought back, as I was reading it, it was so evocative of that era. Obviously, I'm not from that era, but in reading it, it really felt that the way he was writing also encapsulated a particular time and place, which for his generation as well was obviously dying off. I think he was one of the I think he was told me once that he'd been to the funeral of like everybody in his friendship group or family group, and he was older than everyone else. He was going to the funerals of people younger than him. So the fact that he wrote all this down and in that sense archived it, I've got some of it in my office now, I'm so glad he had the chance to do that, because that was also his lifetime ambition, to write up his life story, and he only got to do it in his very later years.
Yeah. My family didn't write things down. My dad, as a seaman, had a seaman's log, which is a book which would list all his voyages, the ship he was on, the day they disembarked, the destination, the date that they got there, his conduct during the voyage, etc. And then it would give his role, and his rank would change throughout the years. But there's a very cool stamp in there. Once the war started, the entries became more vague. The stamps were, you know, OMS, on His Majesty's service. And the destinations weren't clear. But he was, it's a really cool stamp in it, which is 1942, I think, sunk by enemy action, which is, you know, I've photographed the stamp and I've published it on Twitter, etc., because it's really, and he would talk about being sunk and what happened and being on an open boat for some time off the coast of South Africa.
I was going to ask, so you obviously got all of this, so was it left to you, or were you the member of the family who said, I want this?
I was interested in the paperwork. I kept, you know, there were other things to be had, and I wasn't interested in those things. But I was interested in the letters and those paper records that would evoke something of who they were, much more so than other keepsakes.
Yeah. And do you think that's informed your fiction writing to any extent?
I mean, I think it has, yeah. I mean, there's not so much... I mean, there's a whole... the key thing in the book about the Little House on Everywhere Street, which is the title of the book.
I was going to say, don't worry, I would have got it in before the end.
Yeah, Little House on Everywhere Street, available for pre-order, is very much concerned about family and what makes for a happy family, and that being the most important thing to survive the experience. And I did, I have written and published lots of stories about Liverpool, about boys in Liverpool, there's a character who features in lots of those stories, who is kind of a composite of both of my grandmothers. And both of my grandmothers were, one of them was originally from Ireland, and the other one was Liverpool. But they had very hard lives, and their husbands died early. Mm. And they had to do whatever they could to survive. And my maternal grandmother was a very tough woman. Mm. You didn't argue with her.
But I've got to ask you something, because I'm fascinated about the job that you do now. Because again, it just goes to show that we label people, no, that's the wrong word, we pigeonhole people in certain ways, which we have to do to get by. We couldn't function uh-huh. otherwise in yeah. terms of the person who, whether it's the person who, you know, does the, you know, the, switches on the electricity, or somebody who cleans the floors, or somebody who serves the lattes, or somebody who writes the books, or mm-hmm. delivers the books, or all that sort of stuff. But in your case, with all the QA work, I mean, was that something that you... obviously, you're extremely well qualified in doing that, but was that sort of something that you wanted to do?
No.
Was it no. Thank you.
There isn't a child alive who's age seven thinks one day I'm going to be head of quality assurance. Yeah. Yeah. No, that doesn't happen. I mean, I got involved in higher education, in the administration, and I was happy to do that because it gave time for me to use a different part of my brain. Mm. In the downtime, as I say, there are similarities. I think it's mostly about reading and writing. There are texts I have to read, I have to interpret. My job is to interpret those external requirements, so that the university remains in good standing, and to devise a framework for how to work. So when people come to check on us, they can find the right evidence. I'd have to say it isn't all glamour, but it's still reading and writing.
Yeah, it's different. I think you're right, because I find that I have a very different style of writing. I say that. Then again, people have read my the workbooks, as it were, the academic stuff, but the diaries are not really known. There's always a big part of me that thinks I ought to do something with that. But I'm also aware that, probably when you think of all the breaches of confidentiality, you can fictionalise it. But politicians get away with it. I'm reading Alistair Campbell's diaries at the moment. And you think, maybe because they're writing about people in the public eye, then in that sense, even though they're writing about the Prime Minister of the land, then it's okay. You know, Tony Blair's not going to sue him because he's written about him. But if he was to write about me or you or somebody who doesn't have the keys to Downing Street, maybe then it would be a different sort of set of dynamics. And I'm always interested in that, the different stuff. And in your case with QA, because obviously that's a big, or has been historically, a big part of some of what I do. But you need all of them. I suppose they all in their own way complement each other. Uh-huh. That in the same way that, you know, you might go to the cinema to unwind, but if you spent your whole day making movies, then you wouldn't go to the cinema to unwind. You have to find something. Or a good example, Hawaii. If you live somewhere like here, then Hawaii would be like in a magical, but I've been there, you know, to holiday. But if you live in Hawaii, where do you go? You probably go to New York or somewhere really built up, because it's the counterpoint of where you're used to.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, they are quite different. My role that people see me in, it isn't who I am. Mm. And people are welcome to make that discovery or not, which is fine by me. I come in, I do my job, I give advice, I go home, and then I do something else.
Yeah.
So that's fine. That's fine by me.
Yeah.
My wife, who also works at Kent, says that my superpower, my real superpower, is that I somehow cause people to underestimate me. And so, which of course lets me get away with lots of stuff. Yeah. And so I've been doing that for a long time.
Yeah. You see, it's interesting, isn't it? Because sometimes you want people to know as little about you as possible, but in other contexts, maybe even on the same day, you want people to know everything, or maybe more about you than you let on. Just a bit, you know, if you're promoting a book, or if you're at a meeting when you're dealing with, I don't know, quality assurance matters, there's different needs that need to come through. But that's interesting in terms of the way that we all do it, I suppose. And you know, I've found sometimes that I can be with my students in a room and I can talk fluently for 2 hours, but I'll be at the supermarket checkout and that dreaded question, what do you do for a living? And you talk about teaching religious studies, and suddenly you just suddenly realise you've lost all agency and autonomy that you could have. And you think, well, how can I talk about that professionally, but I can't have a normal conversation with somebody at the checkout about that without feeling a little bit defensive. And so in that sense, I guess it's a good strategy that you've adopted. But also, are you watching other people watching you?
I don't think I am. I don't think I'm that fussed, to be honest. Okay. I mean, I go about and do my job, but people are interested in me and they want to talk to me and get to know me, then fine. If they're not, then I'm happy for them to see me how they always have done.
And your family, though, have they read the book? I mean, obviously, I'm sure they're amazingly supportive of you.
Yeah, they are. I mean, I've been writing for a long time. Yeah. And we're all pleased about the book. It didn't happen overnight. I mean, I've been writing different voices, different styles for a long time. There was my younger daughter, when she was about 8, became obsessed with a group of with a trilogy of short stories for children by an American writer about a school called Wayside School. They're very wacky stories, and we would begin with the first one. Each volume has 30 stories in, and they're very funny and very unusual. And then we go through this. At bedtime, we'd read 3. The next night, the next 3. We'd go through all 3 books, so 90 stories, and then start again. Yeah. She loved those books. Yeah. And we decided, well, I decided to Christmas to write one. And so I wrote the 30 stories, and my wife did some of the illustrations based on the style of the book, etc. And we made her into a character and put her into the stories with the other school children at Wayside School. And then we got it printed up just for the house and gave it to her at Christmas. She still says it's her favourite book. But my wife said to me, this is what you should do. So while I was now writing stories and they were being published, etc., I wasn't seem to be making the sort of headway that I wanted to make. Each time I would think, this is going to open a few doors, and each time it didn't. Yeah. So writing for that other audience made me access a different way of writing. Yeah.
Had you written the book before you got a publisher on board, or you know, is it the chicken or the egg story?
No, yeah, I wrote. So after that, I did try to write a book for that age group, and did that. It was quite long, and I put it to one side. Didn't get anywhere, and so I started the Little House story. I knew from the first page. I know it's an odd thing to say, but the first page and a half just came out, and I thought, this is it. This is just gold. And so it does start well,
yeah.
But then it was able to be funny.
But it clearly continues in that vein.
It was able to be funny and humorous, and it was quite easy to write, really. Yeah. The first person who read it actually was Frank Richardson, who works here, head of finance.
Okay.
And him and his son read the first draft. His son was about 12 then, and they enjoyed it. Frank did say, I suppose it would deserve to be published. Thanks, Frank. Mm. But so...
Frank advice.
Frank advice. but, you know, so there are times when those little bits of support keep you going.
Yeah.
You know, if, as I mentioned with Dave Reason, if Dave Reason could believe in me... I always believed in myself, but having that little bit of external support as well, because my wife believes in me too.
Yeah.
So that's been quite supportive. But it takes a long time. So I wrote the first one. I think it was 15, 16, to be honest. And tried some agents and didn't get any kind of response. And after a while, I wrote a second one. I wrote the sequel. I thought no one's ever going to read the sequel because no one's read the first one. And that was a bit more wild and a bit more wacky in style. But then I had some success with the first one. So,
well, that was going to be my next question.
Yeah.
Are there any other books in the pipeline? But there obviously clearly is one. But are you? Is
there are two actually. Ooh. There's a sequel, and then there's a third and final part. The sequel, I think, is. And I've wrote that quite a while ago. I've edited it again and again. From my point of view, that's done. That's good to go. Mm. The third part I wanted to write so I could finish off the whole story. And I have finished that. I finished the first draft. And I put that away in June. And I haven't written anything since. But I plan to go back to it after Christmas to try and start to... It was quite useful, actually, that it took so long for the first one to be picked up and to come out, because I've been able to go back and retrofit it for all the things that happened in book two, to leave Easter eggs for those things. So it looks like the best planned book ever.
You see, I love this, that you've got your own trilogy, you know, Lord of the Rings. I don't know what you call it, Dixon of Dockside.
that is a joke going back to 65.
Is it?
Yeah. Little House Everywhere Street, a trilogy,
But I mean, this has just been incredible to find out your story. But as we start to wrap up, Malcolm, the question that I always ask everyone is, you know, as you look back on your life and career, are your memories predominantly positive ones?
Yeah, they are. I mean, they. Everyone's life has ups and downs, has, you know, moments when you're not in good health, etc. But in terms of the perspective, it's a positive. I have a positive view.
Yeah.
I mean, the things that have happened to me, good and bad, have made me who I am today.
Yeah, and I suppose that concomitant, is that the word I mean? The corollary of that, which is whether you can be nostalgic about negative experiences. Because I suppose to be a writer, sometimes, you know, you're not just going to draw on, hey, isn't life wonderful? You know, that has to be a challenge and also an opportunity. Yeah. It has to be a battle of some sort. You know, it's the whole Jungian Joseph Campbell story. But does that apply in your life as well?
I think I'm at peace with what's happened in my life. I'm not nostalgic, to be honest, about much. And my daily part of my life seems like a long time ago. I'm glad for the way it happened, but I don't look back with it thinking, oh, I wish I could still do that or still be there. Strangely, what I am nostalgic about is my children's childhood. And the things we did together as a family that we don't do now. I mean, they're both away, both coming home for Christmas, and it's great they're out and they're living their lives and they're doing well. And it's a good feeling to think that they're happy and doing something that they're interested in. But there's those. For me, it's quite a recent memory, more recent for them than it is for them, in a sense. That being an enclosed family unit where you have all these shared experiences and you play these games together and do all this sort of stuff together. At Halloween, this Halloween which is gone, was the first one where we haven't been engaged with it because both kids were away. My wife and I can still remember the first one when our younger daughter came down the stairs in like a tiger suit and it was like two. And for us, that felt like a short time ago. Mm-hmm. But now she's 19 and is living in Edinburgh and making music and so. Yeah.
Yeah. No, and I can see pictures of my own children. I mean, I said they range between 6 and 9. But so not that many years ago. And I don't even recognise some of, you know, when they're born. I mean, some children look exactly, you know, when they're young. And, you know, years later, you recognise them immediately. But sometimes you think, no idea. Just like a generic face. Yeah. Or it doesn't match the eye colour or if they have hair. Actually, my children were born with hair, yeah. But then later, you know, years, it all changes. But that what that does to the disruption, I suppose, almost, of trying to sort of work out the age of your children and the places you go, and also the friendships you build up, like nursery, for example. Mm-hmm. I mean, for years, several years, I was 2 or 3 days a week going down in the morning to the Oaks nursery, uh-huh. and in the evening, picking them up. And then that feels like a lifetime away going uh-huh. now, and it was 4 or 5 years. But yeah. but that what that does to your sense of context and history, uh-huh. I think is phenomenal.
Yeah. I mean, it is curious, but there's they do say the films about Toy Story are really about the sense of parents feeling abandoned by their former playmates. Yeah. And so we are Woody and Buzz.
Yeah.
And our children, my children, have moved on from that kind of play sense. I mean, but we're still very close, of course.
Yeah. And are you in touch with many friends from your past, from Liverpool or Minnesota, indeed?
Minnesota more so, yeah, I think. And the book has been good for that, because I've got in touch with all of them and said, buy this. There's, from my childhood, not so many. I had some good friends. We were good friends for a long time. I found that once you move somewhere and you start and you fold into the family, the time you have contracts for those external friendships, etc., and you become focused on, I felt anyway, I became focused on the family. But, of course, social media has helped. I'm still in touch with friends from New York who were originally from Twin Cities. And there's maybe only 4 or 5, really, that I've kept in touch with constantly throughout that whole time period. But I've recently, as I say, because the book is about to come out, and we're all together in the School of English. Everybody had these ambitions. I've been to lots of people. We're kind of rekindling that old friendship. I've got more email exchanges going on with people than I had for a long time.
Yeah, I lost touch with so many people that I'm now back in touch with again. And in some cases, it just feels as though no time has passed. You're just picking up on conversations that you had 30 years ago.
Yeah, yeah. So I think we are the same people.
Yeah,
just that we've got more time now.
Yeah. Oh, I've got that to look forward to then, because I don't feel that at the moment.
No.
And my very last question, Malcolm, are you a looking back or a looking forward kind of person?
I'm both, actually. I look back because I do look back to draw on my life for the stuff that I write. But I'm looking forward to the future. I don't wish I was back in the past. I want this moment from here on in to go forward. And for more things to happen.
Yeah. Well, good luck with the book.
Thank you very much.
By the time this podcast comes out, it'll be, if it's not already, a bestseller. And you'll have more than one award. And you want to give the title again one more time?
The Little House on Everywhere Street.
Malcolm, it's been such a privilege to catch up
with you
this week.
Yeah, you too. Cheers, Chris.